The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
You are listening to KMRE 102.3 Bellingham and KAVZ in Van Zandt, and it is time for Cascadia News Now. Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham are off this week, and they will be back next week. We do have some great things ahead. Dave did a great interview with Congressman Rick Larson, and Liz Darrow will be talking about some local responses to the jail proposal that's coming up. But first, we are still suffering from air quality issues in Bellingham. Bellingham remains unhealthy, and it is projected that we will have unhealthy haze and smoke until Friday at least. And I want to just let you know, it's certainly been frustrating for people who are not able to walk or people who have sensitivities. And yet many of us don't think about, or hadn't previously to this week thought about, what life must be like if you are a farm worker in this kind of environment, in terms of the haze, in terms of the heat, and in terms of the smoke. And it is a horrific thing to report that this week, 28-year-old Onesta Silva Ibarra was a temporary farm worker in Sumas, and he died on Saturday, August 6th. It was during a heat wave in Sumas. The temperatures were in the 90s. There was haze and smoke in the air. Reports say that Ibarra had a H-2A agricultural visa, and that allows for nationals entry into the U.S. for seasonal agricultural work. He first became ill Monday, July 31st, and according to reports, he complained of a headache to the managers at the farm, and that was on Wednesday. And after returning to his cabin, he was allegedly told that he had to return back to work. Again, this is from reports in the field. Ibarra then requested to be taken to the airport to return to Mexico, but his visa had expired June 30th. He went to a local clinic. He was eventually transferred to Harborview Medical Center. Ibarra was initially treated for dehydration and later suffered cardiac arrest. Ibarra died Saturday. He has a wife and three children. The company is Sarbanand Farms in Sumas. They are denying that Ibarra told supervisors about his medical conditions or his illnesses. And everything that I have been saying and everything that I will be saying about this report is collated from different sources. You may have seen Kat C's article in the Cascadia Weekly, and there's been other articles around. We've been communicating with the people who are leading the efforts in response to his death and the response from the other farm workers. Of course, they are so busy in terms of what happened that they were not able to be on the show today. We hope that we will be able to speak with them directly in the future. So I just want to clarify what I'm saying, I'm getting from reports. We hope to hear directly from people in the field coming up on a future show. So again, according to these reports, Sarbanand Farms denied that Ibarra told supervisors about his medical conditions or his illnesses. And then King County Medical Examiner, who got involved when he was transferred to Harborview, King County Medical Examiner's office said that the death was not suspicious, and they are saying that the death is not under investigation. Fellow employees are saying that Ibarra did complain, and they were exposed to long work hours and unsafe conditions, which, of course, we have seen in other parts of the country and other parts of our state and county. What happened next is that workers began to protest Sarbanand and the working conditions that happened. And as we all know, this was a set of circumstances that is unusual for Whatcom County. And yet, the level of heat and the temperatures that hit Whatcom County are not necessarily unusual. But there was an unusual combination of of events. And so workers protested Sarbanond. They claim that the company is mistreating workers, inciting them to work in unsafe conditions at the blueberry growers' job sites, and also providing inadequate food, and that they that the combined high temperatures, wildfire smoke, and the lack of access to healthcare contributed to Ibarra's death. And remember, he was transferred to Harborview Medical Center, not St. Joe's. So, according to varying reports, over 7,200 workers have been fired by Sarbanond for insubordination after refusing to work, and also are currently displaced from their living quarters. And farm workers are saying that they called for a day-long strike on Friday to protest the poor working conditions and Ibarra's death. And civic engagement coordinator at Community to Community, Edgar Franks, says that Sarbanond management is threatening to withhold paychecks now from the farm workers unless they sign a separation notice, or they would not receive their last paycheck. So they are being forced fired for taking a stand for their rights, according to these reports. According to Edgar Franks, the notice says that the workers are being fired for insubordination. For again, what we're hearing is standing up for their rights. According to that Cascadia Weekly report that I mentioned earlier, about 80 migrant workers are in a makeshift camp now at a Sumas home. And reporter Kat C. said that citizens, farmers, and local businesses flocked to the Telegraph Road home, scrambling to fulfill the most basic needs of the workers who came to the U.S. under H-2A visas that promised employer provided food, housing, and transportation. Again, an H-2A agricultural visa is something that allows a foreign national to temporarily or seasonally perform agricultural work without any other rights or benefits, as far as I know. According to the Cascadia Weekly, Jesus Moreno, a 30-year-old picker, said, "They said we had 1 hour to leave and kicked us out on the street, which is why they're in a makeshift camp in Sumas." Because of their H-2A status, fired workers will now be classified as undocumented, stuck here in Whatcom County completely unexpectedly. And there has been an outpouring of help. If you would like to help, I urge you to contact Familias Unidas por la Justicia or Community to Community. And Community to Community's website is foodjustice.org. Again, these are the reports that I have. There are reports that are changing all the time. The situation is changing all the time, which is why some of the lead people and the lead organizers couldn't be here today, because they're on the ground. And of course, that's where they need to be. I can't go off and say I know exactly what happened. I can't go off and say I know Sarbanond's position, and there is a possibility that Sarbanond maybe has an excuse. But from everything that I see, if somebody dies and there's this kind of combination of situations of heat and smoke and haze and long hours, and it's 90 degrees, something is wrong and something has to change. You're listening to Cascadia Weekly. I'm Stephanie Contours. Moving on, citizen reporter Liz Darrow spoke with Edgar Franks and Rosalinda Guillen from Community to Community Development and Junga Subadar from the Whatcom Civil Rights Project and Racial Justice Coalition. And this is about their organization's responses to the Whatcom County Jail proposal.
I'm Edgar, formerly here at Community to Community Development. I volunteer for the Racial Justice Coalition and also the Red Line Salish Sea. When we talk about benefiting our community, you know, it's making sure people can walk around freely without having to be harassed by police or by racists and whatnot. Safety in the ways that, yeah, we can go shop and not get stared at. And, you know, that's the kind of safety. And when it comes to my mind, when we talk about community safety. however, I think that notion of, like, feeling protected has been co-opted by people like, say, the sheriff department, the police department, the prosecutors, for their gains to build a new jail, using a lot of kind of like the rhetoric of social justice to make people feel like the jail is going to be the thing that keeps us all safe. You know, you're building a huge jail. People are not going to want just an empty jail. There's going to be a plan put in place to make sure that those beds are full at all time. You know, at the end of the day, whoever benefits economically, that's the thing that we should be also looking into all these things. You know, the city council talks about the hook of how most of them said how they were going to be voting, why they're supporting the jail. Is because we're going to be $30 million for services, quote unquote. But they're going to be provided in a jail setting. And we think about like community health and mental health. Like, is it really healthy to go get the services you need in a jail? Like, what does that do to your psyche? You know, you're already criminalized and you're going to a criminal facility to get the services you need. In the long run, it's going to lead probably to even a bigger jail, you know, because once 480 people can fit in a jail, they're going to say, you know what, there's too much crime in here. Well, now we need a bigger jail. So now it starts building off that. So offering a jail as a solution and portraying it as a benefit to the community, I don't buy it, especially when there's tremendous amount of money being thrown at it, when we know there's other parts in our community that are getting funding cut, youth programs and so on and so forth. You know, it's our money. So when the sheriff gets mad for us asking a couple of questions, you know, we have to remind him that he's the one that's working for us. Our money's on the line. We're paying him. We're paying for this jail if it passes.
My name is Junga Subedar, and I work with the Welcome Civil Rights Project. Volunteer with CDC and also the Racial Justice Coalition. And I like to talk about the jail tax that is going to be on the ballot in our community in November. I think it's a really important issue for everybody in our community because it will change the economy and I think the culture in our community, as well as increase incarceration and change the public safety, like decrease the public safety even more than what we see right now. So I think that's why it's an important issue that everybody needs to find out more information about if they don't have enough information, and really think hard about and honestly about how they should vote on that in November. The VERA report, in their preliminary report, and the Civil Rights Project has also been looking into data for 2 years, and our data and reports and information have shown that that people of color are most definitely disproportionately represented in our jail and has been forever. So we don't think that trend will change. It will just probably get worse. There's a headquartering of Homeland Security Services out there already, and it's close to land that, empty land that was now bought by Homeland Security. And that land was originally owned by our county executive, Jack Laus, and he sold that, I believe, over 4 times above the market value of that land. So he made some private profit from that land as well. So it's very disturbing and problematic, and we should really be suspicious about Homeland Security purchasing land next to the jail site. Because, and why that's significant is because, one, the numbers of the costs for running our mega jail out there do not add up by accountants and people that are very familiar with doing costs and cost analysis. And so the trend in many other communities for jails, the way they are run, so they don't overrun their costs so they can meet their costs is by leasing out beds to big operations like Homeland Security. And we see now even more of that under the current administration, where they are leasing beds from county jails. That is a known practice and has been even encouraged by the government in Washington. It's very feasible to assume that that's how they would meet their costs out there, is that they would lease out beds to Homeland Security since they have land there and expand that way. And the other reason why that's likely too is because there is a movement in the Tacoma area, where the present regional detention center for immigrants is located, and they may not, the city has imposed a ban on expansion for that facility, and may even look at revoking their business license. If that happens, they, Homeland Security, needs to find another bigger site, and our community may just fit that bill. To be honest, all the studies that I've read correlate, there is no correlation between more policing and increased safety. Actually, a lot of that, many times it shows the inverse of that. And if we have a mega jail out there with a new, possibly expanded regional immigration prison, and I think prison is a better term than immigration detention center, that means there's going to be more police enforcement, law enforcement, ICE enforcement, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE is the acronym for that. And so it means more police presence, more militarized police enforcement. I mean, we are a border town, and a lot of there's already a lot of enforcement from Customs and Border Patrol and the immigration officials close to our border. But there will be even more of that if we have a new detention center out in the county where we live. And more police presence doesn't necessarily mean that there's more public safety. It's usually less. People are afraid of the police. They're looking for people. And they're not only out there trying, you know, walking around talking to people. They are out there generally targeting what they call crime. And many times there are crimes that are about people that, it's about poverty, and it's about people that need mental health support, and maybe even just some support and housing. And to address those issues with militarized police enforcement or law enforcement makes us more unsafe. It means more of a mass incarceration community and culture that we're building here. It will be on the ballot, but speaking out and speaking publicly, it goes on the record, and I think that people's voices have a lot of power and have a lot of sway, because other people will hear you. Even if the politicians don't hear you, maybe your community members will hear you, and maybe our elected officials will be eventually swayed by, so if there is enough public pressure.
Well, my name is Rosalinda Guillen with Community to Community Development, and I just want to thank the folks at KMRE for this interview. Whatever number of beds will be in that jail, disproportionately, most of them will be filled by Native Americans, Mexicans, farm workers, and Black people, if you know, whatever communities of color are around, that's what's going to fill the bed. I think that C2C, or Community to Community, has been in this community as an organization for 14 years. It'll be 15 years next year. I can't believe it. But it's been really clear how the veneer of a progressive liberal city and county is believed and how it's maintained. So the issue of how will this mega jail hurt us, there's just no question that it will. And the local law enforcement, we've seen a progression over the years of the militarization of local law enforcement, grants to Homeland Security that have been funded, equipment either given to the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office or the Bellingham Police Department, or the most obvious one is that huge so-called communications van, this battle armor van with super sensitive hearing microphones and all that kind of stuff. Over the years we've seen how the Whatcom County Police Department and the Bellingham Police Department has slowly been militarized, not just in the equipment that they have, but in their behavior and in the way that they train their staff, the way they behave towards us. And it's been getting slowly worse and worse. It's less about community safety than it is about control. And while we're not there yet towards total control and fascism, it's building in that direction. And all we're saying as residents of the city and the county, as citizens, is we have questions, we have suggestions, and we don't agree with the direction that you're taking our justice system. From the ground to when you interact with citizens and residents, to the arrests and the detention and the jail and the court system and the sentencing, the whole thing, that we have serious concerns of the direction that this is going. And when you put that together with then what's happening with the federal government in Washington, D.C. and the Justice Department there, and the mandates that they're sending down, there is in our opinion, a looming danger to our ability as voters, as citizens of this country, to be able to expect real justice from our so-called justice system. It is common knowledge that when elected representatives say things like, "This is the best police department in the world. This police chief can do no wrong. We cannot consider an ordinance because we might offend the sheriff." That is fascist behavior. That is county council and city council members abdicating our right to dissent. And that is not why we elected them. We elected them to govern and to listen and to consider everything before making a decision. And yet we see consistently in these last few months, the city council and the county council making a decision without any consideration to what the community needs, only what they think law enforcement needs. I understand that people need a chance to make it right. And this is what I would like to also say to the city council and the county council and the sheriff and the county executive and the mayor and whoever else has power is, back up. Pull back, sit down, talk to us. How can you make this right? This isn't about power. This is about making it right so that our community can feel safe. And the only thing that we can do is try to have these public conversations, because it has to be public. It can't be in a back room cutting a deal. That's not how we work. That is not how democracy is supposed to work. It's not how this country was founded. But that jail is going to be built right next door to Homeland Security. And we know that it's going to be difficult, well, maybe not, depends on how hard the county comes at us on filling those beds, but that it's a money-making machine, that jail. They have to have those beds filled, or otherwise why build it? And that's our big concern. It's right next to Homeland Security. Homeland Security, Jeff Sessions, and the administrator, the person in charge of Homeland Security, had said over and over and over again, we want every single county in the nation to have a holding center, because we want to pick up quote-unquote illegal aliens, criminal illegal aliens all across the country, and we need somewhere to put them. and they want the county jails. I mean, it's just like, this is the direction it's going. This is why we have a problem with this. It's going to be used to detain as many undocumented people in Whatcom County as they can and fill those beds. Many of you in Bellingham said that at the beginning of the year. You said that at the election. You said that on January 20th. Well, this is the work that goes with disagreeing with what happened at the last election. And this is the tough part in your own community with your own neighbors and your own family disagreeing here in your own backyard about what our local leaders are doing. They're not perfect either. I understand that, but they can be better. And I have all the faith in the world that when pushed to the right space, they will do better because they have to if enough people join us in opposing or having the dialogue with them.
And that was Rosalinda Guillen from Community to Community speaking about the jail proposal for the Whatcom County Jail. You also heard from Junga Subedar and Edgar Franks from the Whatcom Civil Rights Project and Racial Justice Coalition and Community to Community. This is Cascadia News Now. I am Stephanie Contouris, and I want to thank Liz Darrow for taking the time to get that report. And if you have something that you'd like to say about the jail, you are welcome to reach us at our Facebook or at CascadiaNewsNow.com. And you are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham, KMRE.org, and also KAVZ 102.5 in Deming and Van Zandt. Again, Cascadia News Now, Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham are off this week, but will be back next week. Speaking of Dave Willingham, he did an excellent interview, if I do say so myself, with Congressman Rick Larson, who asked us if he could stop by, and this is what they talked about.
This is Dave Willingham. I'm sitting here with Congressman Rick Larson. Thank you for sitting with us, Rick.
It's a pleasure to be here on 102.3, my first venture here.
And we very, very much appreciate it in this, you know, summer muggy day in our little warm box here. You wanted to come and talk to us some about your Youth Access to American Jobs Act that you've brought up again this session.
Yeah, there's quite a bit going on in Congress that I don't know that folks are paying attention to because there's all this other noise going on about the president and so on. But the job and the work of Congress continues. And one of those main issues that I'm especially interested in is how we train young folks for that next generation workforce. I think that Congress can give a better deal to American workers and to the next generation workforce. I think that a better deal means better skills for young folks. So I have this bill, the Youth Access to American Jobs Act. What I'm trying to do with this bill is to give states the opportunity to experiment with connecting high school students to apprenticeships and then those apprenticeships to real jobs through the community college system. Now, we do apprenticeships in this country pretty well when it comes to the trades. We don't do apprenticeships very well when it comes to future high-demand jobs, say in healthcare or in high tech. We need to give states the ability to experiment, to do some pilot projects with apprenticeships in order to, in my view, to prepare for an economy that continues to change, continues to be buffeted by global trends, and put our workers in a place in the future where we can continue to compete.
So in a lot of high-tech spaces, we don't have many traditions at all, but we don't have much of a tradition of apprenticeship now. And you're trying to kind of create that pipeline?
Yeah, I am trying to create that pipeline, and not just in high-tech, but in other higher demand fields that our Department of Labor, our Bureau of Labor Statistics, our own state has identified as jobs, high-demand jobs in the future. So what this bill will do is create a 2-2-2 program where you identify, give kids who are the junior and seniors in high school some opportunity to start thinking about apprenticeships. You get them into 2 years in community college, and then you get them 2 years into an internship. I think that there is a lot of opportunity in the United States to use this as one more tool to prepare that next generation workforce. Again, we need to give our workers today and tomorrow a better deal, and doing a better job at preparing them with better skills in the future is an important part of that. And my bill, the Youth Access to American Jobs Act, is designed to do just that.
And so, like you mentioned, this would create a pilot program through Department of Education to 10 organizations around the country to try and build this. Is it based on anything? Is there a model here that has worked?
We pilot projects in 10 states. The states would be able to be flexible in how they organize their apprenticeship programs. If you want to look at models, how this would work, we can look at other westernized, industrialized countries, Germany and Switzerland, for example. I think the number is 70 to 75% of all students who go to higher education in Switzerland, as an example, go to a two-year program and into internships. But good-paying jobs are going wanting right now. Over 25,000 jobs in Washington State today in STEM and science, technology, engineering, math are going wanting because we don't currently have the pipeline of kids to fill those roles.
So in addition to this act, you've also been pretty active this session in supporting voter rights bills, including the 2017 America Votes Act, mm-hmm. which would make it easier for people living in states with voter ID requirements. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Very serious about, and a lot of us in Congress are serious about voting rights. One thing, you know, obviously very concerned about now is the president's so-called Voter Integrity Commission, which comes across like a commission designed only to purge voter rolls or find ways to make it more difficult to vote. And voter ID laws in this country, I think, are designed to make voting more difficult. They're actually voter suppression laws, in my view. What the America Votes Act does, my bill does, is to say if you're in a state with a voter ID law and you show up to vote and you don't have the correct voter ID, you get to vote your ballot, not as a provisional ballot, but as a counted ballot. And then you have to. Then you go back and show your appropriate ID. Right now, in a lot of states, you either with voter ID, you don't get to vote at all, or you have to vote a provisional ballot. I think this will work because one, Washington State, we have a so-called voter ID law, and only in that, when you register to vote, you have to show ID. Only when you register, but when you vote, you don't have to because we vote at home. We vote by mail. And the only person available to check your ID really is you, yourself. You have to sign an affidavit on the ballot that says you are who you are. And under penalty of prison time and fines, you vote your ballot. And if you're shown to be a fraud, you'll be in prison or you'll be fined. Higher penalties for voter fraud, I'm all for. I'm for lower barriers for actual voting. If you're registered to vote, if you're eligible to vote and registered to vote, that should be all you need to vote, in my view.
So it kind of feels like an undercurrent of this century so far has been this kind of low-level conflict over voter rights. And it feels like it's been going on for a long time. And I don't want to discount the work of, like, Reverend Barber in the Southeast, but it doesn't feel like it's captured the imagination of people. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And, yeah, Reverend Barber, I think in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, and many others around the country have really pushed back on both voter ID laws as well as changes to dates and time frames and where people can vote in order to expand the franchise and expand the ability to vote. I'm not quite sure why we haven't been able to capture – people's imagination a little bit more, although that doesn't mean we're going to give up. I think that it's more insidious I think the requirements and the limitations put on voting is more insidious than it has been in the past. You know, in the 60s and before, it was largely, you know, if you were an African American,
or if you did, people didn't, you know, like you otherwise, there were a lot of simple ways that the people who ran elections could stop you from voting, and some of those just were so egregiously evil that it just became really kind of crystal clear for folks that the laws needed to change. It's a little tougher to argue against, well, you know, in the past we didn't vote, we didn't allow people to vote early on a Sunday or a week ahead of time, so why should we be forced to allow people to vote a week ahead of time now? Well, that's a good argument, except that if you had that law in place and then you took it away, there's really only one reason you'd take it away, and that's to prevent people from voting. I think we just need to continue to lay out in practical terms, what these hurdles to voting means to our democracy, and talk about it in terms of fairness for everybody.
So here in Washington, we have universal vote by mail. Oregon now has automatic voter registration. Do you support those nationally? Do you think that model could work nationally?
I'm a co-sponsor of a bill to have motor voter and automatic registration. Vote by mail, I think it works. It works for us. It works for Oregon. I think that's probably going to have to go state by state. I don't know that we should mandate that nationally, I don't think we need to mandate it nationally. But I do think that only because it's not addressing a barrier to voting. People can still vote even in a non-vote by mail state. What we have an obligation to do in Congress and therefore nationally is to ensure that the barriers to voting for those who are eligible to vote and register to vote are as low as possible. However states decide how they want to conduct their elections, the barriers to voting should be as low as possible. And I think that's where that's where the sweet spot is for Congress.
All right. Well, the big headline thing now for most of this year and probably for weeks to come is the fight over healthcare and the attempts by Republican leadership in the House and Senate to change it dramatically to fund a massive tax cut. How has that been going?
Well, you've described it accurately. There is a explicit connection between repealing the Affordable Care Act and the taxes that help fund it to the efforts by the Republican majority to finance, pay for a massive tax cut that would largely benefit the richest Americans. There's just no other way to describe why they're doing what they're doing. The fight to stop what I call Trump care has gone pretty well. Has gone pretty well. In the House, we did not succeed in stopping it, but we did succeed, and I think a lot of folks need to take credit for this. A lot of citizens need to take credit for this. We did succeed in raising the political hurdles that the Republicans had to jump over to pass their version of Trump care. It is extremely clear that the House version of Trump care would knock 24 million people off of health insurance. It will increase premiums. A recent analysis of one of the Senate versions of Trump care shows that by 2026, premiums will increase 100% for people, 25% by 2018, 50% by 2022, and 100%. So what Trump care means is fewer people will be insured, your neighbors will no longer have health care insurance, your premiums and your neighbors' premiums will increase astronomically. That is what the Republican health care package means. And we just need to continue to fight to stop that. And again, raise the political hurdle, because as they say about members of Congress, we don't see the light until we feel the heat. And people need to continue to feel the heat on their efforts to strip away health care from their neighbors.
So it feels like we're in this kind of loop. There was a version of the healthcare changes in the House that failed, and then there was a version that succeeded. There's been, at the time of this recording, I think two versions in the Senate that have not succeeded, and it kind of feels like they're gearing up to try again with what is basically the same thing. Are they just going to keep pushing this over and over again until it gets through?
I don't know what the Senate majority leader's plan is, whether it's an attempt to continue to vote to try to bring up their version of Trump care until they get the 51 votes to do that. The problem that Senate Republicans have is that so far every plan they've put up means more people uninsured. It means health care will cost more for people. As one senator who is so far, as of this recording, as she has held out and has refused to vote to proceed on this debate, she said that she wasn't sent to Congress, she wasn't sent to the Senate to be mean to the people she represents. And this is a Republican. So I think that the folks who are holding out really do kind of see it that way, that they're knocking millions of people off of health insurance. Happens to be Medicaid. I think the Republicans thought that because they were cutting Medicaid, that most people would say that's just healthcare for the poor, and therefore we don't have to care about it. And as it turns out, quite a number of middle-class folks depend upon Medicaid. Medicaid is nationally pays for about 50% of nursing home care. So you have a lot of moms and dads whose moms and dads are in nursing homes around the country, and maybe they depend on Medicaid. Medicaid pays for a substantial amount of treatment and recovery services for what is clearly a nationwide opioid epidemic. And you want to cut Medicaid, you're going to cut treatment and recovery services for moms and dads who are maybe depend upon Medicaid to help their son or daughter through this addiction of opioids. So it's not just – Medicaid is not just healthcare for the poor. It's healthcare for the middle class. It provides a safety net for a lot of our neighbors, a lot of your neighbors, and a lot of neighbors of Senate Republicans.
So we've talked about some of the big headline issues, and it feels like a lot of the national attention is on the antics of the president and his, alleged connections with foreign governments. What's happened?
Well, just one in particular, Russia.
So far. What's happening in Congress that you think people here in the 2nd District should be paying more attention to?
That's a great question, because I think that some of the actions, some of the activities that Congress is taking to address this issue in Russia haven't been in the news lately, because so much attention has been on what the president's been doing. But the Senate and the House intelligence committees continue their investigations into the alleged, in all fairness, so I've got to say alleged connections that the president has to Russia, specifically to Russian interference in our election in 2016. That's a big deal. The president has tried to make this argument that this is really about did Russia influence the outcome to result in his win. I don't even go that far. I think it's bad enough that the Russians interfered in our election, and I care about our democracy and our democratic republic enough to care about that. The president could do himself a favor first by recognizing the concern that many Americans have, and that is just the fact that Russia attempted to did interfere, according to our intelligence communities, did interfere in our elections, and there ought to be something done about that. But he won't do that. But as anything, they even said this about this came up. This term came up during Watergate. The cover-up's always worse than the crime. There's not even an allegation really of a crime in formal circles. I have a lot of people write into my office saying the president's committed a crime. But in formal circles and the folks who actually make these determinations, there's been no determination. There's been a crime committed. However, the actions the president has taken sure makes it smell like something wrong happened. That is, the cover-up, the actions he's taking seem to show that he's got something to hide. And he needs to come clean. My limited understanding of this president is that he is not one to give up a fight. He is one to pick a fight. He is not one to show humility so far. And I think he just may be unable to come clean with whatever he has to come clean with. But the flip side is Congress isn't going to stop looking. The special counsel, which I support, and I support Special Counsel Mueller, I do not support the president firing him. There's been some discussion about whether the president would fire him. I do not support that. The special counsel needs to have the independence and freedom to do his job, and it may lead to nothing, and it may lead to something. But that's what investigations are for. And once an investigation is completed, then Congress can make determinations about what it ought to do, and the special counsel can make determinations about what his recommendations would be as a result of that investigation.
You talked about the opioid crisis. This is not, you know, our first in recent memory drug crisis. We had the methamphetamine crisis as well, which, you know, hit Snohomish County like a bomb. I remember that well, and Skagit and Whatcom. What could be done at the congressional level to address that better?
Well, last year, in the President Obama's last term, or last year of his term, we passed the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act. Then we funded it as well. So what that bill did is several things. One, in an immediate sense, it helped fund the availability of Narcan and naloxone for local law enforcement agencies. This is the drug that is the opioid overdose reversal drug. So it saves lives. It doesn't, though, stave off addiction, but it does save lives. But the second thing this bill did is fund four states grants that help them develop, further develop treatment plans, treatment centers, and recovery centers. I talked to local parents about their experiences with opioid addiction because their child, son or daughter, is a victim of this crisis. And they're really clear that treatment is important, but recovery is equally important. Treatment doesn't get you recovered. Recovery gets you recovered. And so the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, or CARA, helps fund treatment and recovery plans as well. So now we need to continue funding it. And we're not off to a great start with this president. He's gutting the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which does a lot of public education around drug addiction. And he has proposed cuts to mental health and substance abuse services. I think Congress will eventually reject those cuts, much like we're rejecting a lot of his cuts, his proposed cuts that he has proposed so he can give tax cuts to the richest Americans and increase the defense budget beyond our means. We have some work to do in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, to push back on him. So there are some things we can do. The structure's in place. We put it in place with this law. We now need to continue to fund it and fight off the president's proposed budget cuts to that funding.
So you're not just the representative of the 2nd District. You're a resident of the 2nd District. And as a Washingtonian, you know, at the time of this recording, our legislature just banged the gavel closed, ended their session without passing a capital budget. Have you been following that? Are you?
Not particularly. I was born and raised in Arlington, Washington. You know, I'm very fortunate to be able to represent a district that I was born and raised in, and have family in the Whatcom area. My family settled in the out near Deming in the late 1800s. The church that sits at the corner there of Lawrence Road and Mount Baker Highway, my great-grandparents built it. They're buried in the cemetery there. I got roots up here. So I do follow what goes on up here. I follow what goes on in the district and follow what goes on in the state. And as a citizen and a taxpayer, I have a real concern about what the legislature does. My main concern is that they did something with McCleary, the education fix. as well as transportation funding, because I'm on the Transportation Committee in Congress, the only member from Washington State on the Transportation Committee. And, you know, building, repairing, and maintaining our roads, our bridges, our highways, and our transit systems is critical for our economy and critical for creating jobs and having better jobs here in the Pacific Northwest. But I follow tangentially most other issues in the legislature. And I think if you talk to legislators, they probably say the same about Congress. they've got their business to do, and I've got my business to do. So I know the capital budget's got a hiccup related to something, but I couldn't quite go into any detail on what that is. But I can give you a lot of detail about a lot of other things in Congress.
Fair enough. So, you know, we talked about some of the clownery in the administration and
buffoonery is a better term.
There you go. Yeah. And some of the missteps of the leadership in the House and the Senate. But what we haven't seen, at least in a national polling way, is that people are clearly saying we're not happy with the president. We're really not happy with what Congress is doing. But it hasn't turned into an advantage for Democrats yet.
Right. Yeah. Sort of like, what about you, Democrats? Oh. Right. Yeah. The there was recently a string of tweets about what the Democratic theme was in 2006 when we got the majority when Bush was president. And a lot of people were there was actually a theme we used in 2006. But people were tweeting things like, we're not George Bush, or, you know, just things like we weren't the other guy. And I think, you know, it's middle of 2017. I know a lot of folks are focused on 2018, the election. Frankly, it's a little early to be focused on the election 2018, in my view, as somebody who is going to be running in that election. I can tell you that 2 years ago and 4 years ago and 6 years ago, you know, at these same times, I wasn't focused on the next election then either, and yet won. So I think that it could be a little early. But I do – and when I talk to local Democrats, I do say this, that at some point the Democrats need to flip the switch from being anti-Trump to being pro-Democratic. And there isn't a date when that has to happen, but it does have to happen. But looking forward, I do think that there are some lessons from the 2016 election, and there's some things to think about going forward in terms of what Democrats are for. And then people can make some choices. I'll go through just a couple of those. But another way to think about it is I tell Democrats, like President Trump will deliver 49% of the vote to the Democrats. What are we going to do to deliver the next 2%? And what are you going to do to get the majority? Because voters want to vote for something, not against something. That is not lost on the Democratic Party at all. The Republicans are going to have to own the top of their ticket, just like Democrats had to own the top of the ticket when Obama was there. And Republicans will have to own the top of their ticket. So we don't have to do much about Trump. We have to do a lot more about Democrats. So I think first and foremost, I think about my experience in winning, and I got 64.5% in 2016, the highest percentage I've ever got. And I look back on other elections I've won and when I've run and won in 2010, where I barely won, but I still won. If Democrats don't get back to talking about jobs, and the way I talk about it is in infrastructure, building roads, bridges, and highways, that puts people to work, not doing the things that are nice to do, but doing things that we need to do, we need to have done to help our economy. The reason I talk about the Youth Access to American Jobs Act is because the next thing we need to be thinking about is recognizing that people are still concerned about the economy. They're concerned about global trends that impact the ability to create jobs in the United States. And how do we stay competitive? How do we ensure our kids are ready for that? And that's why it's important that we have a commitment to training that next generation workforce, that there's a commitment, a covenant between the Democrats and the voting public and those who don't vote, that we understand that anxiety that moms and dads have about what the future is for their kids. And finally, I would say that for Democrats, we need to talk about inclusion. I think we got a little wrapped around the axle about inclusion meaning inclusion for only some people in 2016. Inclusion means everybody. The Republicans, from a national party perspective, and I know a lot of good Republicans, and they're my friends, and they would agree with me that their party is not seen as a party that wants everybody to be included. They talk about opportunity, but they want to help anybody get to that opportunity. We need, as Democrats, to talk about how we're going to help everybody, whether they look like me or not, whether they vote like me or not. We have to be in a position to say we want everybody to have that opportunity and build the country that gives everybody that opportunity. So, you know, we have to offer something that shows concern for today, jobs, a concern for tomorrow, what's the future look like for your children, as well as something that's aspirational, a country where everybody actually does get to be included in the opportunity to benefit from what the country has to offer. I think we can structure messages around that. That's what I've tried to do in running for office in the past, and we'll do so in the future as well. And that's the message I'll take to my leadership.
And our most demanded question has been about Amtrak funding, and there's been a lot of threats to their long-haul routes. And here in the Northwest, you know, Amtrak is probably my favorite way of traveling. And what's the state of that?
Well, Washington State itself has invested well over $100 million over time into both operating Amtrak in a partnership with Amtrak, as well as into the rail system that supports Amtrak. So it's something that I've followed quite closely in my 17 years in Congress. I think that this administration, much like it has approached all infrastructure spending, is pretty lackadaisical and fairly circumspect in their support for Amtrak. They see everything as strictly a zero-sum game, and as well as if you're not making a profit on anything, then you're going to shut it down. Well, it's not exactly how transportation systems work. So I'm very empathetic, sympathetic with folks who want to continue the Amtrak funding. I support that. I'll continue to support it. We'll see what we can do to, again, fight off or stave off any proposed cuts the president has for Amtrak.
Thank you for joining us, Representative Larson.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Representative Rick Larson, Congressman Rick Larson, interviewed by Dave Willingham on Cascadia News Now. And we will have that on our website if you would like to go back and revisit it very soon. If there was a lot of conversation in there. Thanks very much, Dave, for getting that interview. This is Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ. I'm Stephanie Contours. My normal co-hosts, Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham, are off this week. They will be back next week. I would like to give a very big thank you to our citizen reporter, Liz Darrow, who spoke with Edgar Franks, Rosalinda Guillen, and Junga Subedar for our feedback from different community organizations on the Whatcom County Jail proposal. Cascadia News Now is edited by Dave Willingham, produced by Stephanie Contours. Our engineer tonight is Robert Clark. Thank you so much, Robert. And host Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and I will be back next week. You are listening to KAVZ 102.3 in Deming Van Zandt, KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham, and KMRE.org all over the world.